The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Stay hydrated. It's hot out there.
So my teenage son just went out in sweatpants and a hoodie. It's 98 degrees. At least I know he'll be cool in our house, thanks to Atlas Butler. If something goes wrong, they'll fix it within 24 hours. They call it their comfort pledge.
Get too hot?
I need my phone.
Oh, your phone. Should have known.
Atlas Butler is at your service. Call 1-800-FURNACE.
Hi, Crimes of the Centuries listeners. I had to record a little intro today because, while you probably can't tell it, this is episode 1 of season 5. Season 5! I didn't take a break between seasons this time around, so we're rolling right into it, but I wanted to say thank you to all of you who make the show possible. It, along with Grab Bag Collab, is now my full-time job. I'm out of daily newspapers, which I will miss, but it was all getting too much to juggle, and you've made this show successful enough that I'm taking a leap. Reminder, you can get early and ad-free versions over at grabbagcollab.com and or Patreon, where I aim to start releasing more bonus material as well. Plus, you'll be supporting other shows, like Catalyst, which takes a look at the origin stories of some of history's most disturbing killers. Or, if you want something lighter, check out Why is Amy in the Bath? A deep dive into film history through the lens of a sudsy Amy Adams. Or feel free to stay right here in this feed. I appreciate you more than you know. Now, let's begin season 5. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. When Perry Parker got the ransom note demanding he pay up if he wanted his kidnapped daughter returned to him, he must have scoffed. $1,500? Even in 1927, that was a paltry amount, at least in this context. The most infamous kidnapping for ransom case in U.S. history at that point had been Little Charlie Ross in 1874, and those kidnappers more than 50 years prior had demanded $20,000. Perry Parker would have paid any ransom if it meant getting his 12-year-old daughter Marion back, but the successful Los Angeles banker could pay $1,500 without blinking. It was a done deal. The ransom note, of course, demanded Perry not reach out to law enforcement, but come on now. What parents wouldn't notify the police? The missive had arrived the morning after Marion was taken from school December 15, 1927, by a man purporting to be one of Perry's co-workers. Marion's family had realized she was missing soon after school let out, so they had naturally been worried all night and had already alerted tons of people that Marion was missing. If the kidnapper expected them to keep quiet about things, he shouldn't have waited so long to deliver his message. While the note Perry read was terrifying, promising to kill little Marion if the Parkers refused to pay up, its orders seemed clear enough. Perry was to deliver the $1,500 to a man in a car at a meeting spot to be announced, and in exchange, Marion would be released unharmed from the car's back seat. The evening of December 16, 1927, Perry got the phone call he'd been waiting for. The male voice told the frantic father which LA streets to drive until he reached a spot on Gramercy, where he was to dim his headlights and wait for the kidnapper to approach. Perry did as he was told. The handoff should have happened soon after, but it didn't. Perry waited and waited and waited. Finally, at 11:45 p.m., his heart heavy, he gave up and drove back home alone. He was disappointed, terrified, and confused. He had done everything he'd been instructed to do down to the letter, or so he thought. When he returned home, he learned that he had unwittingly violated one of the rules set forth by the kidnapper. He'd been ordered to come alone. Police, who had been staking out the Parker home, followed him when he went to make the ransom drop. Two carloads of officers had trailed Perry to the meeting spot, thinking they were far stealthier than they were. If Perry hadn't been so nervous and distracted, he might have noticed. Perry didn't, but the kidnapper did. He aborted the swap and wrote the Parkers a scathing letter that arrived the following morning. It described how Marion had been anxious to go home, how she had sat waiting for him in the kidnapper's car. Quote, "She was eager to know that it would only be a short while and then she would be free from my terrible torture, and then you mess up the whole damn affair. Your daughter saw you, watched you work, and then drove away severely brokenhearted because you couldn't have her in spite of my willingness. Merely because you, her father, wouldn't deal straight for her life. You're insane to betray your love for your daughter, to ignore my terms, to tamper with death. You remain reckless with death fast on its way," end quote. Inside the kidnapper's envelope was another message, this one written by Marion. It read, quote, "Daddy, please don't bring anyone with you today. I'm sorry for what happened last night. We drove right by the house and I cried all last night. If you don't meet us this morning, you will never see me again. Love to all, Marion Parker," end quote. The next day, her father followed all the rules, for real this time, in hopes of bringing his little girl home. He met the kidnapper again, asked to see his daughter's face as proof of life, then handed over $1,500. What happened next sickened the nation and was declared by the LA Times the most horrible crime of the 1920s and the case of the century.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, it's Jenny and Bill from Simple Bath and Kitchen. If you're anything like us, you want to be able to trust a company while getting a great value.
That's why at Simple Bath and Kitchen, we focus on what really matters. You, value that's not hidden, and a team you can trust.
With designs that are tailored to your needs and honest, upfront pricing, we make your dream kitchen or bath attainable.
Discover the team Columbus has trusted over the last 15 years.
Simple Bath and Kitchen, where our home is your home.
SimpleBathandKitchen.com.
Nearly every criminal case I can think of has a slew of what-if Shakespearean sliding door moments in which a series of events just had to happen just so for the thing to unfold the way it did. These are always heartbreaking to me, especially in retrospect, when it turned out someone's life hung in the balance. Perry and Geraldine Parker had no idea when they awoke that fateful December 1927 day that someone was about to set such a series in motion. They would later learn how many things had to have gone the kidnapper's way for the result to be what it became, and that would haunt them and others for the rest of their lives. But let's back up before all that was known, back to even before the Parkers were a typical upper-middle-class family in Los Angeles. Perry Marion Parker had been born in Pennsylvania in 1879 to his homemaker mother Mary and his physician father William. He was the third son born in quick succession. His birth marked the last of the couple's boys, though not the last of their children. three daughters followed. Based on available documents, Perry grew up comfortably in his large by today's standards family. He always had a head for business, so it made sense when he set his sights on a banking career. In the 1900s, he met and married Geraldine Heisel, a Missouri-born woman who was 8 years younger than he was. The two had their first child, a son named Perry William Parker, in 1907. It would be 8 years before Perry and Geraldine gave birth again, but when they did, it was a twofer. They named their twin girls Marjorie and Marion, the latter taking her father's middle name so it was spelled the traditionally masculine way, with an I-O-N at the end instead of an I-A-N, though plenty of newspapers would get that wrong in the wake of the tragedy. The girls adored their older brother, who in turn was quite protective of them. While the twins weren't identical, Geraldine often dressed them alike and got them matching haircuts, but the girls were definitely their own entities. Marjorie was more like her mother, quiet, girly, a bit on the shy side. On the other hand,
those who knew her described Marion as a nice child, who was a bit of a tomboy. She had lots of friends, but preferred to spend time with her family, playing trains and throwing footballs.
That's from Briefcase, and it's backed up by the book Butterfly in the Rain, in which author James Nibauer wrote, quote, "While the girls, including Marjorie, would play with dolls and tea sets, Marion would be enjoying toy trains or sometimes even football with the boys. Yet, despite her tomboyish nature and athletic bravado, Marion was, in other ways, an emotionally delicate child," end quote. For example, she was scared of the dark and a bit of a homebody. She could play outside during daylight for hours, but once the sun threatened to set, she wanted to be home with her family. Sleepovers were not her bag. She also was on the shy side around adults or other kids she didn't know well. Now, around her friends, she was the opposite, totally outgoing and even goofy, dancing to the radio or phonograph. She loved the physical humor of silent stars like Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd. Harold's the guy from the silent era with the round, wire-rimmed glasses dangling from a clock on the side of a building. Anyway, all this is to say that while Marjorie was a lot like her mom, Marion was really close to her father. So much so that she sometimes accompanied him to his job at the National Trust and Savings Bank, where he had worked for 20 years. She would roam the building, politely chatting with officials or watching the tellers work from afar. As it turned out, someone was watching her in return. The morning of Thursday, December 15th, Marjorie and Marion bundled up against the cold winter wind and walked to the streetcar that took them to school. It was supposed to be an extra fun day at school because teachers were hosting Christmas parties and winter break was nearing closer. What 12-year-old doesn't get excited about the holidays, or if not that, at least the holiday break? For the most part, nothing was noteworthy about that morning, with one small exception. The twins noticed there was a man who seemed to be trying to get their attention from his car. Marjorie thought he might have even been trying to wave them off the streetcar, like motioning at them to get off and talk to him. That, of course, made no sense, so they ignored the guy. Things were mostly normal at school, too. The slight exception there was that Cora Freeman, the principal, was off that day, which meant that the top-level decisions at Mount Vernon Junior High School would instead be made by Mary Holt, a teacher in charge of registration and attendance. In hindsight, this should have been a safeguard against what was to come because Holt was known to be a stickler when it came to attendance. She was the type to insist parents had good, documented reason for taking their kids out of class early. Kids didn't dare try to pull one over on Holt. Her strictness was legendary. And yet, around noon that day, when a young man entered the school office and told Mrs. Holt that he was a friend of Perry Parker's and needed her to release the quote-unquote Parker girl into his care, she made a decision that would haunt her for the rest of her life. She believed him.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer.
Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
The man who approached Mrs. Mary Holt at the front office of Mount Vernon Junior High School was unremarkable, appearance-wise at least. He was a smaller guy, both short and slender, with hair cropped tighter on the sides than on the top, which had a charming, messy, curly, bouffant thing going on that he tamed with pomade. He was polite when he approached. "Excuse me," he said, "I need to see the Parker girl." A faintly sad smile crossed his freckled face. Holt was immediately a tad confused. There was no singular Parker girl at her school, but the man was friendly enough that she just let him speak. "I work with Mr. Perry Parker at the bank," he explained, then got to the point. "Mr. Parker has been in an accident and is calling for his daughter." Holt said, "But wait, we have two Parker girls. Which one does he want?" The man didn't know this, but thought quickly on his feet. "He wants the younger one," he said. Now, in hindsight, this should have raised all the red flags. Who asks for the younger one when talking about a set of twins? But it so happened that because Marion was a tad smaller than Marjorie, they sometimes joked that she must be the younger of the two. And Holt had heard this joke. So instead of asking an open-ended question, she instead asked, "Do you mean Marion?" "Ah, yes," the man said. "That is her name." See what I mean about the what-ifs in this case? Later, after the details of all this emerged, parents of children in the school would be baffled. Holt had refused to release children to their own grandparents before. She was known to track down parents by phone to verify outsiders' identities before letting her school children walk away with them. Yet she didn't do that this time. Maybe it was because of the man's story that Perry Parker was hurt. Maybe it felt more urgent to Holt. And the man before her wasn't remotely pushy about things. I mean, he seemed concerned about Perry's accident, but he wasn't frantic. If anything, he seemed relaxed, confident. Holt trusted him. The Los Angeles Times quoted her later testimony in 1927. She said, quote, "He seemed very well educated and extremely courteous and calm. He completely convinced me, and I'm always very careful about excusing children, even questioning parents as to identity and reasons for the desired absence," end quote. But Holt trusted him so much that when he said, "You know, feel free to call the bank to confirm all this," she didn't bother. She sent an assistant to fetch Marion Parker. When Marion arrived, the man told her the reason for his errand. Of course, the girl was immediately worried. "My kiddo's nearly Marion's age now, and if he were called to his school's office and told I was hurt and asking for him, I think he'd trust the messenger. Marion did." She left in such a rush with him that she didn't even grab her coat. Of course,
Perry Parker had not been in an accident.
This is The Murder Nerd on YouTube.
When Marion didn't return home from school that afternoon, the Parkers launched a search but didn't find anything. So the next day, they went to the police to report her missing. Very soon after they made the report, they received a telegram that was addressed from Pasadena. It was a ransom note.
The order of this might be off. Some reports say what Murder Nerd said here, that the Parkers alerted police before the ransom note came. But I read a couple of books on the case, and the better of the two, Butterfly in the Rain, has the Parkers calling police after the note arrived. In fact, it says, quote, Perry Parker wrestled with the conflict of wanting to contact the police about his beloved daughter and warnings from her kidnapper not to do so. He paced the floor, weighed all of his options, and was haunted by a series of what-ifs. Was Marion being hurt? Being attacked in any way? Was she only frightened, or was she also undergoing any one of a number of hideous possibilities? All of these thoughts consumed Parker's mind. Finally, he could stand the wait no longer. He phoned the police, and they quickly arrived to question the family so they could begin to search for Marion. End quote. Now, if you're a longtime listener of this show, you'll know that kidnappings were not unheard of in this era. Marion's disappearance came 3 years after the May 1924 kidnapping and murder of Bobby Franks by Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb. We covered that awful case back in season one. And in Los Angeles, around the time Marion disappeared, police were juggling five other missing children reports. One of those cases involved a 17-year-old named Lillian Runyon, who on December 10th had left with a, quote, strange young man in a dark coupe, end quote. In questioning Marjorie about Marion's disappearance, police learned about the guy who'd seemed to be beckoning the girls off the streetcar on their way to school. Could that guy and this man in the coupe be one and the same? Police at first thought it was possible. Meanwhile, another letter came for the Parkers. Quote, use good judgment. You are the loser. Do this. Secure 75 $20 gold certificates, U.S. currency, $1,500 at once. Keep them on your person. Go about your daily business as usual. Leave out police and detectives. Make no public notice. Keep this affair private. Make no search. Fulfilling these terms with the transfer of currency will secure the return of the girl. Failure to comply with these requests means no one will ever see the girl again except the angels in heaven. The affair must end one way or the other within 3 days, 72 hours. You will receive further notice, but the terms remain the same. Fate, end quote. Another letter accompanied this one, though, and it was in Marion's handwriting. Quote, I wish I could come home. I think I'll die if I have to be like this much longer. Won't someone tell me why this had to happen to me? Daddy, do what this man tells you or he'll kill me if you don't. End quote. It was signed Marion Parker. Harry Parker begged police not to go to the press. He just wanted to meet the ransom demand, get his daughter back, and go about his life. After the exchange was made, he agreed police could do whatever they had to do to get the guy off the streets, but Perry wasn't about to do what Charlie Ross's dad did more than 50 years earlier. Christian Ross had refused, on principle, to pay a ransom demand. He'd figured that if he paid for his son's return, kidnappings for ransom would skyrocket. So he had refused and spent his whole life wondering what had happened to his son. Perry Parker couldn't imagine a fate worse than that. He told the police to stand down, keep as low a profile as possible, and do the investigative work on the back end. Police agreed, or at least that's what they told him. In truth, they had trouble taking this kidnapper very seriously. The $1,500 ransom demand seemed amateurish. Perry Parker wasn't rich, but he could afford more than that. The cops felt it was more likely that Marion had been taken by someone with a vendetta against Perry Parker, so they interviewed friends, co-workers, neighbors, relatives. None jumped out as potential suspects, but they felt pretty confident that whoever did this was no sophisticated criminal. He was likely just some jerk with an axe to grind.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer.
Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
After his daughter was kidnapped, Perry Parker tried to act as normal as possible, per the kidnapper's instructions. He went to work and, aside from pulling out $1,500 from his personal bank account and spending time writing down the serial numbers from each of the $20 gold certificates he'd withdrawn, he carried on well enough that outsiders had no idea anything was amiss. It wasn't easy, of course. Perry went to work at the bank and worried someone would ask how his family was doing. The question alone could trigger a breakdown in him. Plus, people at the bank knew Marion. She was the daughter he often brought to work with him, so it wouldn't have been odd for someone to ask about her. Luckily, no one did that day. Meanwhile, police were gathering all the information they could, which included spending a long time with Mary Holt, the school administrator who had released Marion into her kidnapper's care. Holt was bereft. Imagine her position. She had been tasked with keeping the students in her school safe, and it was a job she had always taken seriously. She was known for her diligence in this very arena. Yet, this one time when it mattered most, she had let her guard down. She told police everything she could remember about the man who had conned her. She estimated he was between 25 and 30 years old, about 5'8" and 150 pounds, of slender build with thin features. She remembered his freckles and that he was cleanly shaven. He had dark brown wavy hair that had glistened a bit from the product he used in it. Police were relieved she had paid such close attention. They tried to make her feel better, assuring her that her detailed description would likely help them nab the guy. But Holt was so distraught, she had to be sedated to sleep. On Friday night, Perry Parker got a phone call from a male voice asking if he had the money ready. Parker said he did. His instructions came in another call about 20 minutes later. He was told to get in his car and drive a specific route to Gramercy, just north of 10th. Parker agreed and promised not to bring the police. He intended to keep that promise. He left his house with the money and did not alert detectives. As author James Neubauer wrote, quote, "Vengeance was not on his mind, only his child's safety. He could think about justice later," end quote. Briefcase again.
Unfortunately, the police who were investigating the case had followed Mr. Parker without his knowledge. And when the kidnapper realized what was going on, he fled.
It was as though the police hadn't even tried to be subtle about tailing Perry Parker. Perry didn't notice, of course. He was too consumed by the task at hand, but the kidnapper spotted the cops straight away. Parker was furious when he found out after the failed money drop what had happened, and absolutely petrified when the kidnapper's angry letter arrived the next morning. Not only had police screwed up the drop, but they had given reporters time to learn about the situation. The story of Marion Parker's kidnapping was now making headlines. "Hunt Kidnappers of Girl" was emblazoned across the front page of the Los Angeles Evening Post Record. "Ruse lures child away." In reality, the story got all kinds of things wrong. Really, the evening editions of newspapers back in the day were as rushed as some of our online quote-unquote scoops today. Trustworthy journalism takes time, folks. First isn't always best. Among the errors, The story said Marion, misspelled with an A, had been approached playing with chums outside of the school when a guy in a dark coupe approached and told her that her dad had been in a car accident. It conflated the coupe case I mentioned earlier, the one involving 17-year-old Lillian Runyon. It also suggested that some of the other missing children's cases were connected with Marion's. Other early stories made similar mistakes, but eventually, the facts started to surface. An innocent 12-year-old girl had been taken from her school, and now her family was desperate to get her back. The media interest was so great that Perry Parker finally spoke out. As reported in the San Francisco Examiner, he said, quote, "We'll do anything, anything at all to get our girl back. No sacrifice will be too much," end quote. Tips began pouring in. Most were bogus. The Parkers worried the heightened publicity would scare off the kidnapper, but his missives kept coming. Here's Nigel Foxworthy of 50 States of Mysteries reading one of them.
PM Parker. Fox is my name. Very sly, you know. Set no traps. I'll watch for them. Get this straight. Remember that life hangs by a thread, and I have Gillette, razor, ready and able to handle the situation. Do you want the girl or the $75, $20 gold certificates, US currency? You can't have both, and there's no other way out. Believe this and act accordingly. Before the day's over, I'll find out where you stand. I'm doing a solo, so figure on meeting the terms of Mr. Fox. Or else, fate.
One of the notes referenced a Parker neighbor by name, apparently the kidnapper's way of saying, "Hey, I did my homework." It also warned, quote, "When you play with fire, there's cause for burns. But not W.J. Burns and his shadowers either. Remember that," end quote. W.J. Burns, as in William J., a former Secret Service agent and past director of the Bureau of Investigations, which later became the FBI, who had launched the Burns Detective Agency. Perry Parker didn't tell his wife Geraldine about the threats in any detail. She could have read about them in the newspaper, but refrained. Her nerves couldn't take it. She focused on keeping Marjorie as calm as possible. The couple's other child, the older boy named Perry, wasn't nearly as shielded. In fact, he became his father's ally in the situation, sometimes even serving as family spokesman for the press. As scary as the threats were, police were adamant the kidnapper was all bluster. On Saturday, December 17th, the Visalia Daily Times quoted Herman Klein, chief of detectives, saying the child would walk into her home unscathed yet that very day. The story read, quote, "The opinion was based on information Klein is believed to possess but which he refused to divulge. He indicated that the kidnapper was cornered and from the standpoint of his personal safety will have to relinquish his hostage before nightfall or else sever all avenues of escape," end quote. Finally, the kidnapper contacted the Parker home with the next set of drop-off instructions. Perry Parker complied. While waiting in his car at the agreed-upon location, a man pulled up alongside him. He had fabric covering his face below his eyes and demanded the $1,500. Perry Parker said he had it, but asked to see Marion. The man reached behind him, rustling some fabric in the back seat. Parker saw the silhouette of his daughter's face. Her eyes were open, she was still, and seemed calm. He handed over the money. The next step was for him to be reunited with his daughter. The kidnapper pulled his car forward a few feet and then dropped a bundle on the side of the road. Perry Parker ran toward the heap on the ground and picked his daughter up in his arms. But something felt off. She felt so small. He looked at her face and noticed black thread woven throughout her eyelids. And then he realized half his daughter's body was missing. Her arms and legs were gone. He was holding only her torso, and his baby girl's eyes had been sewn open to make it look like she was still alive.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
As news spread of Marion Parker's murder, the world was horrified. Not only had she been killed, but she'd been horribly mutilated and discarded like trash by a man the newspapers dubbed a fiend and a monster. Perry Parker had wailed like an injured animal when he realized what had happened. Onlookers rushed to his aid and called police, who descended on the scene quickly, but the killer was already gone. This is Scott Michaels of Dearly Departed Tours.
The medical examiner determined that she'd only been killed a few hours earlier.
With the recovery of Marion's body, the case escalated from a kidnapping to a murder investigation, and all of Southern California seemed ready and willing to join the hunt for her killer.
Some clues came by way of Western Union workers who had spotted a man purportedly sending some of the messages that had peppered the Parker home since Marion's disappearance. Those descriptions varied wildly from the man Holt said she saw at the school. Helen Seeley and Ina Branson said the guy was only 5 feet tall and very, quote-unquote, hard-looking, not the 5'8", pleasant-looking man Holt reported. Police, without question, bungled the case early on, what with the way they underestimated the culprit and also surreptitiously tailed the father in so blatant a way they might as well have been driving a car covered in neon lights. After Marion's death, they stepped up their game. That must have been bittersweet for the Parkers. More than half a dozen suspects were questioned within 24 hours. Some of them were cranks. One guy kept calling up the local radio station, shouting, "I am the Fox," and hanging up. Police held 24-year-old Gaylor Barneman briefly before determining he had nothing to do with the case. For a time, they also had a woman in custody. She'd been hysterical near the spot Marion's body was dropped, screaming, "I didn't kill her. They did it. They did it." Ultimately, it was determined the woman, 22-year-old Lillian Padley, was just drunk. Investigators examined the handwritten notes that had arrived at the Parker's home and brought in handwriting and fingerprint experts to weigh in. One news story pondered the way the killer had transposed the I and E in the word received, which felt like a tell when his writings otherwise hinted at a good education. Psychiatrists told the panicked public that the culprit was sexually insane with sadistic tendencies, which surely allayed zero fears. While police didn't get far with suspects straight away, they carefully gathered clues that would prove useful later. One was a towel recovered with Marion Parker's body. It had been traced to an apartment complex called Bellevue Arms. While police searched the apartments and came up empty, the towel would prove useful later on. The manhunt went nationwide and involved more than 10,000 officers and volunteers. Wrote Neubauer, quote, "Even those generating the most marginal suspicion were questioned and released only after detectives were absolutely certain that they had nothing to do with Marion's murder," end quote. One of the tips led police to recovering a Chrysler coupe matching the description of the car Perry Parker said the killer drove. Inside, they found the most valuable clue yet: fingerprints. Howard L. Barlow of the LA Police examined the prints and found a match already on file in the system. The print belonged to a now adult who had been arrested as a juvenile in an old bank forgery case. The print from the car also matched prints on some of the ransom messages sent to Perry Parker. They belonged to William Edward Hickman. Hickman, who went by his middle name Edward, was not between 25 and 30 years old, as Mary Holt had told police. He was only 19 years old, and he wasn't 5'8", like Holt said, nor just 5 feet tall, like the Western Union workers said. He was smack dab in the middle, standing 5'4". But the more police looked at Hickman's background, the more certain they were that they'd found their killer. He had worked at the bank with Perry Parker. More than that, Perry Parker had fired him. A year earlier, Hickman had been caught stealing from the bank using some clever forgery. He'd been released from jail in August. When police returned to the Bellevue Arms apartment with a photo of Hickman, the neighbors there recognized him. They knew him as Donald Evans, a guy who had rented an apartment in the building and drove a Chrysler coupe. When police entered the apartment in question, it was clear that whoever lived there had fled days earlier in such a hurry that a half-eaten breakfast was left on the table. Other items were found linking its inhabitant to the crime, like a thumbprint on a sugar bowl and half a hazelnut in the trash can. That sounds random, but a corresponding half of a hazelnut had been discovered in a towel that had been wrapped around Marion Parker's torso. Now police had a name and a face. On Tuesday, December 20th, so 5 days after he had kidnapped Marion Parker from school, Edward Hickman made his front page debut in newspapers nationwide. "All Southland seeks him," read a headline in the Santa Barbara News Press.
Police initiated a nationwide manhunt for the killer, which consisted of over 20,000 police officers and volunteers.
Some of the tips were nonsense, of course, but even the ones that seemed real were just odd. Two hitchhikers had hopped into a car in California driven by a guy who seemed on edge. He didn't talk much, obeyed traffic laws to an almost paranoid degree, and kept a loaded .45 caliber automatic pistol within reach at all times. It wasn't until after the men were dropped off in Portland, Oregon, that they spotted the driver's picture in newspapers. After that, a gas station attendant in Washington State spotted Hickman and alerted police. Investigators might have dismissed it as a false sighting, but the attendant had been paid with a $20 gold certificate with a serial number matching one Perry Parker had jotted down from his batch of ransom bills. As much as LA cops messed up early on in this case, Hickman's downfall came at the hands of much smarter cops in Oregon. Pendleton Police Chief Tom Gurdane teamed up with a highway patrolman called Buck Llewellyn. Their gut was that Hickman might hear news reports that he'd been made in Washington, likely headed to Canada, so they thought he might double back down south and head back through California toward Mexico. They figured their best shot at capturing Hickman was by staking out the closest major highway. It shouldn't have worked. I mean, there were so many variables at play. But soon enough, wouldn't you know it, they spotted a green Hudson, the same type of car the gas station attendant had said Hickman was driving. Still, the two cops assumed it wasn't the right green Hudson. What are the odds, after all? But they pulled it over anyway. They recognized Hickman behind the wheel. With him, he had two passengers. He calmly asked, "Was I speeding?" The cops made chit-chat and asked his name and what he was up to. He said his surname was Peck and he was traveling from Seattle to visit family. He complied with a request to stop out of the car. From his lap, a pistol clattered to the ground. That on its own wasn't too abnormal. Travelers often carried guns for protection, but the cops got permission to search the Hudson and found a sawed-off shotgun on the floor of the car, another pistol, and $1,000 worth of $20 gold certificates. Chief Gurdane exclaimed, "You're Hickman! I knew it!" Hickman didn't bother denying it. He said, "I guess it's all over." Of course, it wasn't over. Not yet. Hickman confessed to the police, saying he had never intended to kill Marion when he kidnapped her. He simply wanted $1,500, that specific amount because it was the cost of tuition at the college he aimed to enroll in. He remembered Perry Parker had testified against him in the forgery case the year prior and had remembered Parker's daughter because she would join her father at work so often. He hadn't targeted Parker for revenge, he said, but rather just chose the guy because he figured he had enough money to pay the ransom. After he got possession of Marion, Hickman said he told her what was happening and she hadn't been all that upset at first. Just like Mary Holt, she was placated by Hickman's calm demeanor. He'd assured her the ordeal would be over the next night after her father made the ransom drop. The two had talked about comic strips and movies and gotten along very well that first night. But the cops' decision to tail Perry on Friday threw everything off. Marion had seen her father's car and began to cry when Hickman said she couldn't go out to him because he'd spotted the police cars that had followed him. She cried all night. She began to annoy Hickman. Now, at first in his confessions, Hickman claimed he didn't work alone. He'd had a buddy, and conveniently, that buddy was the one who had actually killed Marion while Hickman was out. All of that proved false. Eventually, Hickman would admit that he alone strangled Marion because she wouldn't stop crying. She had just written the second note to her parents, and he was about to mail it, but she didn't want to be left alone. She was scared. You can actually see it in her letter, not just by the words, but by the handwriting. Her scrawl is much shakier in the second letter than it had been in the first. After Hickman fatally choked her, he partially dismembered her in the apartment's bathtub, drained her of her blood, stuffed towels into her body cavity so it wouldn't look so sunken, bought makeup to bring color back to her face, and carefully sewed her eyelids open. 50 States of Mysteries again.
The trial of William Edward Hickman for the kidnapping and murder of Marion Parker began on January 25th, 1928, just a month after his arrest, and quickly became one of the most sensationalized trials in California's history.
The proceedings lasted 3 weeks. Perry Parker seemed a broken man when he took the stand. Mary Holt, the school official who'd made the fateful decision to send Marion off with a stranger, was so stricken she could barely speak. She would never recover from the guilt of what she'd done. Hickman's lawyers centered his defense around an insanity plea. They said he'd been driven by voices in his head he called Providence.
Hickman himself played into this plea, often shifting from rational responses to strange, disjointed statements in the courtroom. He would occasionally act erratically, claiming he was not in control of his actions, yet at other times appeared calm and composed. Hickman also presented a document he called The Solution of Crime, a rambling tract in which he tried to persuade the court to spare his life, claiming he could benefit humanity if allowed to live.
Hickman had his parents in his corner. His mother, Eva, who had battled mental illness her whole life, told reporters there was no way her son could have done this. If he had, he must have lost his grip on reality. Meanwhile, Hickman's father, who hadn't been part of his life for years, testified on his son's behalf in court. He said that his former wife had gone kind of crazy while the two were together. She'd threatened to kill him, to kill herself, to kill Edward, as well as their other children. She told him once that he'd come home from work one day to find his family's bodies piled in a corner of the house. He also said that when Edward was born, he had actually been stillborn. It took doctors several minutes of working on the newborn to revive him, William Hickman said. The first time Eva went into an insane asylum, Edward was just 7 years old. Surely, all of this, matched with the horror inflicted upon Marion Parker, pointed to Edward being insane, his father reasoned. The prosecution didn't buy it, and neither did the jury. He was convicted February 9th, 1928. 8 months later, on October 19th, he was hanged at San Quentin. One headline read, "The Fox Sent to His Doom." According to prison guards, Hickman spent his last day alive marveling at his own crime. He's reported to have bragged that it was the most atrocious crime in history. While it's nowhere near as well known today as the Charlie Ross or Leopold and Loeb cases mentioned above, it made quite a mark in its day. It was the subject of several murder ballads, including this one.
Little Marion Parker, left her home one day and headed for the schoolhouse so very far away. She took her little sister, and little did she know, following in her footsteps, there came a deadly foe.
To research this story, I read I Want to Come Home Tonight, The Haunting Story of Marion Parker. With apologies to its author, I found that book lacking. However, so I switched to the book Butterfly in the Rain, The 1927 Abduction and Murder of Marion Parker by James Neibauer. I also read contemporary news coverage. A lot of the YouTube documentaries on this one have false information in them, so I was careful with the clips I used.
Just as the letter said, but when he found little Marion, his darling child was dead. It was the blackest murder, the awfulest in the state. At the hands of Edward Hickman, little Marion met her fate.
Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Oh my gosh.
Put your hands together for new Dr. Pepper Blackberry and Dr. Pepper Blackberry Zero Sugar.
There she is! Oh, yeah! It's full Dr. Pepper!
With sweet blackberry flavor!
Dr. Pepper Blackberry, I'm obsessed with your succulent taste. Please marry me!
No! Marry me! Marry me, or I'm gonna freak out!
Try new Dr. Pepper Blackberry.
It's a pepper thing!